I was looking forward to a comfortable little group in Koinonia, but fortunately, Carol, who always is pulling me to surprise, fortunately, they didn't tell me this morning that until this morning that we would be here. So I did sleep better the 5 hours that I was in bed last night. And I thought this morning that how close it was that I wouldn't have been here. I had the privilege of being, if not the scientist, the pseudoscientist in residence during the past 2 weeks. And it goes back to an early failure of mine in one of the first experiments. I was an observer child, I think, in the Norwegian community in which I was raised. And although we didn't have any sheep, Emil Eriksson had some sheep. He was a neighbor of ours. And I felt sorry for Emil in the winter because he was feeding his sheep and he wasn't getting any autumn. I mean, we called it bag the buffalo. We milked his cows every day. We shipped them out and we were making ends meet. So, but Emil during the winter had tough sledding. Although in the summer he had a good deal. He was selling the lambs, he was clipping the wool and selling that. But I thought how nice it would be to have a sheep that would hibernate. Now you think about this, it would be really a great thing. You just lose me, you just lose me very well, you see. So when I went off to school, and I kept thinking about this, you know, and why can't we cross, you see, a bear with a sheep? So we did it. But the experiment failed because there wasn't enough wool on the sheep end to cover the bear.
Now, Jim, I looked at Al Rodness, you see, and then he claps. You see, he says, if you want applause, look at him. That's the last one. Now for the discussion today, which is my response to God's great gift, or our stewardship, my stewardship, I'd like to open with a prayer. And it's probably, you can figure it out why it's from St. Francis Assisi. He liked animals too. Lord, make me an instrument of thy peace. Where there is hate, may I bring love. Where offense, may I bring pardon. May I bring union in place of discord, truth replacing error, faith where once there was doubt, hope for despair, light where there is darkness, joy to replace sadness. Help me not to crave to be loved as to love. Help me to learn that in giving I may receive, in forgetting self, I may find life eternal. Amen. You know, I forgot my two readings, or my readings from MacDonald yesterday. As you know, George MacDonald, who I was introduced to here at Holden, has been a companion of mine the years since Al Rodness introduced me to him. And as you know, I've read from him almost every day, and I'm going to read a couple of the readings I was going to read yesterday. And they happen to be both on prayer, in a way. Even such as ask amiss may sometimes have their prayers answered. The father will never give the child a stone that asks for bread, but I'm not sure that he will never give the child a stone that asks for a stone. If the father say, my child, that is a stone that is no bread, then the child answers, I am sure it is bread, I want it. May it not be well that he should try his bread? And there is a communion with God that asks for nothing, yet asks for everything. He who seeks the Father more than anything he can give is likely to have what he asks, for he is not likely to ask amiss. And then these scribblings from a Confederate soldier. I asked God for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I asked for help that I might do greater things. I was given infirmity that I might do better things.
I asked for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing that I asked for, but everything that I'd hoped for. And despite myself, my prayers were answered. I am among all men most richly blessed. When I was taken prisoner as a publicity stunt, the Germans accumulated quite a number of us, and they hauled us into Rome and had a sort of a march. They marched us through Rome to show all the Italians what a bag they had gotten, you see. And they took us into Rome, and they let us off the Colosseum. And I'd read about the Colosseum and heard about it. And I've often thought of this, you know, this fantastic place where Nero really started the real public slaughter of Christians. And I thought then, and I've thought many times since, of this lonely handful of men who loved a loving Savior so much that they pitted, I mean, just a few people against the thousands, against the greatest empire on earth at that time. And to the Roman spectator, I'm sure, the thousands of them, it was really a futile spectacle. But we can look back on it today, as I look back on it at that day, and we can ask, where is Nero now? And where is the cross? And that serves to introduce my stewardship discussion, because a steward is one who manages the affairs of another. And I like to pick a winner. And in picking a winner to whose affairs that I must manage, there are probably certain hopes that you must have. And you must have a firm hope. You must live the resurrection every day. It's an event that can penetrate and change every life. It changes ordinary people. It may not cure your asthma or your arthritis, but it is a hope that will take you probably not from things, but through everything. We talk too much, I think, about hope only when the end seems near, or when the doctor starts giving evasive answers to our questions. Ours should be a lively hope, and we should not rest until we have it. For a false hope is a shield. A living hope can never be extinguished. The plant closes. The doctor is right. It's cancer. Tears and pain cannot conquer it. And we're more sure of it, of this living hope, than that the sun will rise again. And we have many promises. We know that in our Father's house there are many mansions for us. And in looking at stewardship, then, I'm going to sort of look at my stewardship in many areas. First, of the body of self. How should one manage oneself, our body? And then what is our stewardship, perhaps at church? Some brief comments on that. In our home, at work, in closet, and with my neighbor. And how long have I got? Maybe four. Till 10:15, maybe, something like that. Now, just very briefly on the temple, I've discussed it a bit in some of our lectures. But this is one of many of our falling down places. We say and we read that we are the temple of God, but do we really treat it that way, as a gift of God? We do mistreat it. Yesterday, I think I might have given the wrong impression when I talked about cancer, the importance of dying triumphantly, or accepting the diagnosis of cancer, for example, triumphantly. There's another thing you should do too. God has given us good doctors, you know. And when you're suspicious of something is wrong here, you don't say, well, I'm tough. You know, Norwegians have a tendency to do this. Boy, I don't need a doctor, you know. So they wait too long, and they could stay around for a while and be a great blessing. Sinners are called sinners because they corrupt human life instead of really living it. And we must live a life and live it fuller, and we can live it fuller, I think, if we take better care of ourselves, yet realizing that great things are accomplished by people who don't feel very good. And we are going to have difficult times. I'm not saying here that you should sleep 8 hours a night. There are many times that you can't. We have learned yesterday and other times that we must be like Christ. Conrad brought that up to us last night. And he didn't get 8 hours of sleep every night, you know. And sometimes he prayed all night, didn't he? Probably cried many nights too. Sometimes we're going to have to do this. But the time will also come when we must just sort of lay back on our bed when things sort of close in on us and relax and say, well, it's your move now. Jesus, it's your move. I have a big red chair in my office, and when we have to make a lot of tough decisions sometimes, or whenever we have people, we have problems. Maybe that's why I went into the animal world where there weren't as many people. They have fewer problems. But now I also have many people. And sometimes I have to sit down in this chair and it leans way back, you know. And I have to say, Jesus, you put me here. It's your move. Now, how about a church? How should we behave at church? How do I look at this? It isn't enough to be an observer at church. You must be a participant. And it's dangerous to be right at church. You know, Jesus went around robbing people of being right. Remember the people that were going to stone the adulteress? They were right. Moses said they were right because she was caught in the act of adultery. But you can go to hell being right. I can name many others, but we haven't got time. The place of the church, our place in church, we must realize it isn't a comfort station, a haven of rest, a social club, or a fortress. It's an army on the move. And I think we waste a lot of time shielding the church and defending the church. Jesus doesn't need us to shield his church. The Christians are spending too much time, I think, scampering for security, cowering for protection, crouching in defense, and sometimes even rising to resist. Our job is offense. Instead, we must be strident in the attack. The Christian has been commissioned to go into the world and proclaim. And when a Christian loses this fervor, he loses the fact. We must realize in this church, and as we go out, the greatness of the church is not in its membership or in its structure and many of the things we heard last night. The greatness of the church is in its Lord. And he's the one we must be proclaiming. How about my stewardship in my home? This is a common falling down place. It's for me, and I'm sure for you. I don't know, some of you have teenagers now. It's kind of interesting to see the kind of questions they ask when they get to be teenagers. They start thinking about boys. Heard my daughters the other day, overheard them, they were asking my wife how come she happened to marry me. She said, you're beginning to wander too. A wise man once was asked, why is a wild cat a wild cat? And he answered them, because his father and mother are wild cats. And boy, that's true, you know. We have a very important responsibility. And I've often thought that there would be very few marriages consummated if we talk to our spouse before marriage the way we talk to him afterwards. You think about that. Boy, we say a lot of unkind things, don't we? And that's why we raise wild cats, I guess. We should compliment, not criticize. And we must thank God for our spouses and for what they do. Maybe it's a good thing sometimes to send them off for a while and let you as a husband maybe take care of the house and the kids. Boy, that'll change your mind in a hurry. And there's probably a lot of things I should say about this. One of the chief things, and I heard Al Rogner say it once, and this is that the minute we think that our mate got the best deal, you're in trouble, you know. It's like that the boy was getting old enough now, he was going to start thinking about looking for a girlfriend, and so he went to his mother and says, you know, I'd like to, you know, get your ideas on what really makes a good spouse. She says, well, you better go to your father. He got a better deal than I did. It's over when you figure that way. The love is cold. And then how do you sort of give strength in this? And also my children bring me up short on this provoking to wrath, you know. I mean, we get so we just say no to everything, you know. Pick them wisely and pray for wisdom in this, that we do not provoke our children to wrath. And then this matter of family devotions. I don't know how you work it in your house, but you better... This is where you learn worship, and family devotions, at least in our house, is a very important thing. We have it at dinner, and I think that when a child is old enough to talk, it's old enough to pray, and I commend it to you. Stewardship at work. Now, we've heard a good deal about the calling. Oh, there was one other thing I wanted to say about marriage before I get into this. Boy, this tape isn't going to be worth much. Maybe we can... It's easy to erase, so, the whole thing. But I was going to say there's something, because there are quite a few young people here, you know. I hate to tell you how many years I've spent preparing to be a scientist. How many years I went to school and how many books I read and how many papers I read every day. And I'm going to be a scientist probably about 30 years, huh? But I'm going to be married about 60 years. Do you know how many books I read? How to make a successful marriage and all, you know? We think we're born with it, like the weaver bird I told you about, you know? That even if he's raised in a house, after three generations, he goes out and he knows how to just tie the knot and build a nest. We aren't born that way. We got to observe, make good decisions, and read the books. So, Werner, read the books, huh? So you read the books. And the rest of you, too.
And somebody, the man who needs it most isn't here. He wants to tell.
Was that right? Well, maybe the men that need, the people that need it most are here and been married 30 years, you know. 10 years. That's right. We got some good books on this. And instead of wasting time with something else, do something profitable. Learn how to be a good husband or a good wife, a good father to your children. Now, this matter of work. Oh, wait, there was one other thing I was going to say. Huh? And it is this raising of the children, you know? I mean, we have this thing where we just let them run, you know? This is wrong, I think. We got them goose-stepping. Boy, we think this outfit's really shaping up, you know? And I think one of the good analogies here is in the garden. And sometimes it seems that there's more concern and tenderness and more imagination shown by the gardener than the parents raising a family. And if you follow someone with a real green thumb around the garden, you know, the tree is undersized, they handle it a certain way, and if it looks like it's the leaves are turning yellow, then we probably give it a special fertilizer. The tree needs pruning. We spend considerable time studying how to fix this right, you know. And the strange thing about it, I don't think any gardener ever made the mistake of thinking that they made the tree grow. Nor did he think that any two trees in the orchard were supposed to perform alike or look alike. And I think that's a good instruction for us. Now on this matter of work, I get sort of a bug on this. The main thing is to not realize that, I mean, it's a tendency to get into work right since, boy, if I'm a good artist, and if I dig good ditches, or if I do good research, boy, I'm in. I don't mean to infer that at all. But Jesus has called us. We are called to worship him in the place where we are, in our work. And it's about the only sermon that most people will hear is the one that we preach in our work. And we get sort of carried away sometimes to say, well, boy, he's a great scientist, or he's this. And this isn't the important part of it. The important part of it, I think, is that you do it well. I think of the survey that was run, I think it was General Motors Company. And they were trying to find out, well, what was the attitude of the employee? How did he regard his work? How much did he know about what the other people were doing? And in this survey, who really stood out the best? Somebody in management or something? No, it was a scrap collector. Huh? And the scrap collector went at his work, and he could tell you just about how efficient the various departments in this particular plant were. He had studied the various metals on how they were used, and he knew what they were used for. He knew efficiency because he could see how much scrap was coming out and how much they were using. And he had really made a study of it. Or one of the other great ones that I know about was a janitor in a church in Hollywood. It's a janitor. You say, oh boy, lowly. One of the biggest parties they ever had in the church was to honor the janitor. Well, he had been a school teacher, and he was a fellow that he'd babysit and play with the kids. He'd help the students. They could go to him because he knew algebra and he knew geometry, so he could help them with that. And he was kind to all the people there. And when he came to retire, the biggest blow they ever had. And the most important thing, he kept the church clean. In our calling, nothing should be too small or too heavy, too light or too routine or too transitory. All have a place in these monotonous, sometimes monotonous deeds of everyday life. I think it's a good idea for you ladies to put a little sign over the sink, you know. divine service is rendered here every day. I am to put in daily my most eager interest, my strictest conscientiousness, but God's power and God's love. For it's God that continues to create and Christ who continues to redeem through my daily work, and it is a gift. And I'm sure, as we look at, say, Paul and Christ, I'm sure that Paul, who spent a good deal of time making tents, I think he sewed it well and he used good string. Or there would have been a lot of people who didn't pay any attention to what he said. And I'm sure that there weren't very many crooked tables that came out of a certain carpenter shop in Nazareth. And I think Jesus probably spent a lot of time there. And if I, in my work, if I mistreat my animals, if I am not just with my employees, or at least make a sincere attempt to be such, to be honest with them, boy, I better keep my mouth shut about the Christian religion, because they won't hear me for the noise I make, with what I do. Now at the bank. I think that's next. Boy, here they go again, you know. Remember that little discussion we had on tape over at the Koinonia the other night? These kids were talking, you know. They had them taped in this counseling session in one of the high schools. Boy, I go to church, all they talk about is money, you know. How to get our money. And the issue that I like to recall for you at this juncture is it an incident that really did occur, but I'll recreate it for me. Because in my early life, I attended a Norwegian church, and periodically, everybody would stand up and we'd march around the altar and we'd put our money there and we'd go back. And if I, at the end of this lecture today, said, well, we're going to have an offering, or at the end of, say, this was a church service, and I said, we're going to have an offering and everybody's going to march up here. You know, Holden isn't a very good place for this. It's better to be down on earth. And if I then announced it, I put the plates up here, and then I got a high chair, and I sat right down there, you see, down there. And as you each marched up, you know, I really looked you over. And maybe when you opened your purse, I'd start looking there, too. I think you would have to say that I had more than a passing interest in your concern for money. And more than that, I probably watched you as you go out and saw whether you, as I think Jesus did, he probably seen whether they came riding up in a white donkey. And if you heard my lecture, that's very great. If I went outside and seen whether you came up with white sidewalls and a big limousine, I would have also watched that. I'd be pretty concerned about what you were doing there. And a lot of people say, well, we don't hear anything about tithing in the New Testament. But Jesus did just what I told you I could have done here. He sat down, he went in and he sat down opposite the treasury and he beheld how people put in their money. He's pretty concerned about it. He didn't preach tithing. He didn't tell Zacchaeus, when Zacchaeus says, half my goods I give to the poor, you know. Yeah, 10% is enough, Zacchaeus. Well, I'll say he didn't. And then that other fellow who came that was sure he was right, you know. Jesus loved him. The rich young ruler obeyed all its commandments. He told him to go and sell all that he had and give 10%. Give it all. Huh? Give it all. He spoke about five times as much about money and giving than he did about prayer. So I'd say he was pretty concerned about it. And but we haven't heard it. We haven't heard this message. I know in the American Lutheran Church where I was, through the work of the American Lutheran Church, benevolence, the average church member was giving a pack of cigarettes the cost of, or equivalent to a couple of Cokes a week. That's what we're giving. Big deal. We won't get there that way. And Jesus was very concerned about this, and he knew, because he said, "For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also." And that's why he was so concerned about it. We furnish our homes today as if we're going to live in them forever. I got news for you. And Jesus doesn't only look at what we give. I think more importantly, he looks at what's left. Huh? What's left. And I think we should give it some thought too. And then do something about it. Now, what about in the closet? Well, although Jesus didn't say, he said only a fifth as much about prayer as he did about our money. He did say a good deal about it, and he did a lot of praying. And I remember reading, we say, well, we pray unceasingly, huh? We're supposed to pray unceasingly. And I often wondered about this, and I wondered about it till I read about Stonewall Jackson. And I've tried to put this in practice, not as much as I should. But he says, you don't have to kneel prostrate or fold your hands and stand here. You can live a life of prayer. As soon as you get up in the morning, and I know it's tough for some of you, but as soon as your feet hit the cold floor, unless you have radiant heat, as soon as your feet hit the floor anyway, pray God that you'll live a life of pleasing in His sight this day. And you render thanks, you give thanks for the food. On your way to work, you pray that make it a good one, huh? Make it a good one. Before a conference, huh? It's going to be a tough one. You better be there with me. And if you're traveling, if you post a letter, huh? May this letter be a blessing, huh? And then when you pull the shades at night, lay down. All right, Jesus, it's yours now. And I think that was one of the wonders of this Udit, the word, you know. This movie we saw yesterday and the evening before. The faith of this child, and it really believed, you know. We had an incident in our own home on this. Our eldest, which is a son, who unfortunately has never been to Holden Village. But when he was very small, he wanted an animal. He really wanted some rats. And there was one member of our family who was kind of fighting this thing. But finally I made a cage and I got a couple of rats. Boy, these were a big deal, you know. And he had all the neighbors in that evening looking at him, and then we went to bed and he said his prayers, and God bless him, Mama and Daddy, and he went on and he says, and God don't let anything happen to those two rats.
And nothing did happen to him for quite a while, in spite of that somebody else was probably praying that he'd probably disappear.
But his prayer was the strongest.
And now we've come to my neighbor. And you know, I was thinking the other night at the movie on Odit. You know, this Johannes, he went crazy reading Kierkegaard. And I can almost see that one could almost go crazy reading Kierkegaard on works of love. You know, where you love your neighbor as yourself. Boy, that's a tough one, isn't it? But it's worth reading. We started out our lay seminar with that book, which our own Howie Hong and Mary Hinderly and a lot of you, Al was here. Boy, that was a great time. A lot of people I know in our church, in any church I've ever been, they come and they say, well, you know, I haven't got any talent. I can't stand up and talk to anyone, to a group. I can't sing. I'm no good as a teacher in Sunday school. But they can be kind, you know. And boy, we need a lot of that today. I've started a sermon on this, and I've never finished it, but I called it Apples of Gold in Baskets of Silver. These kind words, and that's what they are. I think of Hans. I told you one story about Hans the other day. This is another Hans, and he really existed. And I have an idea. He probably brought more people into our church than anybody else in Richland, especially in the early days. He was a carpenter. He never stood in front of the congregation. He never taught a Sunday school class. He never sang in front of the church. He never sang in the choir. He never played any instrument. But he did very good carpentry. And he went around the town and maintenance. And he'd play with the kids, you know, and he'd do a special good job. Maybe he'd come even back at night, some lady had a problem. And maybe she'd have to go to town, he'd watch the kids, you know. And he'd start talking, you know, you ever go to church, you know? How about these kids? Maybe I should pick them up for Sunday school. He'd do these special little things. He was concerned about his neighbor. I have to ask you, you ladies, are you careful who you invite to your circle? If Rahab the harlot came in, would you say that, well, our circle is full now, why don't you try the Dorcas circle? Or maybe go down the street to the Episcopalian church? Or the Nazarenes probably could do more with her. Or how about the men's brotherhood? Would they invite that crook Zacchaeus in before he met Jesus, huh? You have that crook in your men's brotherhood? It's a question you have to ask yourself. We got a lot of people who are alone. Irv got it last night. I mean, we have to live love. In Northern California, Lutheran Welfare has organized a lay visitation group for convalescent homes, homes for the aged, where I might say many people live for whom nobody cares. There's a lot of people like this. And one of these homes, a lady came one day, and she was wearing Luther's coat of arms on it, and one of the guests there says, well, what's that? And she explained that, well, we're from, she gave the mission, you see. She said, oh, you mean you're from the church? And she said, yes. Tell her she was from the Lutheran church. You get paid, he asked. No, she said, we just do it, come up here and visit you for nothing.
because we love the Lord and we want to help you in any way because he loves you too. And this, I mean, what was his response? He says, well, he says, there must be some hope for the whole world yet. Another Holden visitor really put this home to me. And if you've never heard him, I'm going to bring you just a few words on it. He made Matthew 25 really live for me. And that's Fritz Norsted. And you go home tonight, maybe read Matthew 25. Because Jesus identifies himself with a drunk sitting in Skid Row tonight. Or that vegetable in the mental hospital. Or the guy in jail, and he's probably in jail because he deserves to be in jail. That's Jesus there. Have you ever visited any of these homes for the aged? Have you ever helped a drunk, or did you just pass by on the other side? One day, I think he was a student in the SEM, walking along the street, and here was a guy in the gutter, you know. So he got down with him, and he put his arm around him, prayed with him. And later, this fellow, he was converted. And in fact, he became quite a great preacher. And what do you think really broke his heart? Huh? Was it the prayer, this fellow said? He couldn't remember a word of the prayer. It was that somebody did stop and put their arm around him. That's what broke his heart. Are you afraid you'll get your clothes soiled? Have you ever visited anybody in jail? Jesus is there too. If you've never become involved in any of these missions, you may have missed meeting Christ because he did in fact identify himself with these. We read in Hebrews that it says, let brotherly love continue. Do not neglect to show hospitality to strangers, for thereby some have entertained angels unaware. And this is exactly what happened in the case of a fellow named Kagawa. And as two people left a meeting in which Kagawa talked, it was Dr. Kagawa, it was an American audience, and one expressed disappointment in saying, yeah, but he didn't say anything. Yes, said the other, but you see, we go to hear him because he is Kagawa. What he meant was that the years spent in ceaseless toil and unfailing love to all in Japan, in big cities there, in fighting disease and service in slums, in the jails, and spoke through his halting sentences in his broken English. Could hardly understand it. And the first man, after some thought, said quietly, yes, I suppose you don't have to say much if you're hanging on a cross. You don't, because this cross speaks much louder than any words that can be said. And I think the important part of the story is, how did Kagawa become such a great force in the life of the downtrodden in Japan? It all happened because someone cared. Someone took the law, the royal law, seriously. When still a young man, Kagawa was stricken with tuberculosis. And he was alone in a seaside hut, separated from even his own people, until one day a Christian missionary happened to come by to visit him. And he gave him food and shelter and attention, medicine. And Kagawa said that after the missionary left, now why would a stranger, not even my own countrymen, come by and see me? And the answer, of course, should be clear to all of us. God had come to Kagawa through his friend. Would you take time time to bother with someone. The lonely old lady down the street who's kind of hard to get along with and doesn't understand too well anyway, but just likes to talk. Or the mean kid in the next house who you just like to paddle, you know. Or the mother of the large family that lives near, who never has a moment's peace with all the kids. Or the mother of the retarded or the exceptional child, who doesn't have a moment's peace because she has to always be on the alert, else something will happen to it. Remove the mask from the one in need, and you find God. In that you have done it unto the least of these, my brethren, you have done it unto me. And we have so many promises to live by. Sure, the road's going to be rough. But we can go to this wonderful book and find wonderful things in it. He that keepeth me never slumbers or sleeps. This verse that this wonderful Kalachi brings out, he says it almost every day, I think, probably to himself many times a day. And lo, I am with you always. How many times have you heard him say it? It's true. Or these significant words in this Bible. Him who comes to me, I will in no wise cast out. These were the words of Jesus. And he died for them. That's how serious he was. And he deserves the best we have to give him, even if the best is none too good. I close with a special benediction. The Lord bless thee with the gladness that knoweth no decay, with the gladness, with the riches that cannot pass away, with the sunshine that makes an endless day. Thus may he bless thee. And keep thee with the all-covering shadow of his wings, with the strong love that guards from evil things, with the sure power that safe to glory brings. Thus may he keep thee. It's been a great 2 weeks for me, and I thank all of you for it.
Thank you, brother.